Succession number 19932, Reel 1.
John Bennett, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
A place called Mildura in Victoria, Australia.
Which year was this?
1929.
Can you tell me a bit about your family background, please?
My father was English. He came here to Australia in 1913. He enlisted in the First World War, went to Gallipoli, France, and returned to Australia in 1919. My mother was had been born in Australia, and I don't know a great deal from my mother's family. My mother died when I was 6 years old, but I knew the family, the grandfather, paternal grandfather. So other than having sort of supposedly rich relatives early in the piece, they squandered the family inheritance by the time I came along. My grandfather on my mother's side, my maternal grandfather, he's a prominent landowner in the 1800s, I understand.
In Victoria?
In Victoria, and tied up with the Victorian Parliament. But we've never followed the family history.
What was her
name? I think the family name was Bellamy, though. Other than that, I'm afraid I'm very, very weak on family history.
What did your father do for a living?
My father worked on the railways, Victorian railways, and he worked there all his life until he retired, and he died when he was about 75, some 1959.
What job did he have on the railway?
Guard or a guardsman, yeah.
Did you go to school in Mildura?
Mildura, yes. There were three of us in the family, my a sister, a brother, and myself.
Which school did you go to there?
I went to a Catholic school, St. Joseph's College. Not that we were Catholics, but my mother had been a Catholic. And my father, being Anglican, had agreed to bring the children up as Catholics. But very poor Catholics we turned out to be, unfortunately.
How old were you when you left school?
14. Yeah.
So, you were a schoolboy then in the Second World War?
Yes.
Did the Second World War have any effect on you?
I think so, because we're all gung-ho, I guess. We're very impressionable at that age. I can remember the battleship Sydney sinking the Italian cruiser and was given much prominence. Colleoni might have been the battleship. So we brought up in an atmosphere of war, and of course we had a RAF training base, Air Force training base in Mildura as well. And we saw plenty of aeroplanes. It was a fighter base.
Were the Royal Australian Air Force personnel?
Yes. And a lot of the district men had gone away to the Pacific and been taken prisoner early in the Japanese War, particularly the 2nd 21st Battalion, which ended up as the highest casualty rate of any Australian battalion during the Second World War. Prisoners of war on Ambon and Hainan. I think there's something like 300 survived out of the 800 people.
So the war really had an effect on you from the point of view of following the events, did it?
Yes.
Rather than in any practical terms?
Yes, more than following the events. And when the war ended, of course, the first thing you wanted to do as soon as you became of age was to join the army. And I managed to convince my father that I was 18 when he had a couple had been to the club a little bit too long. And he signed my enlistment papers, so I got in at 17.
So this was in 46?
46.
Do you remember the month?
Yes, March, day of my birthday. Couldn't get down there quickly enough.
Where was the recruiting office?
In Mildura.
What was the next thing that happened to you?
Then we were moved from, well, they got a draft. I think a lot of young people joined up at the same time as I did. And we went to into a training camp at Greeter, which was in New South Wales at the time, for 6 weeks basic training.
What was that like?
Pardon?
What was it like?
Pretty awful. And I'd never left home before, and I hardly knew anybody. Pretty wet behind the ears, of course. I found it pretty difficult. I look back on it now, but it was hard. I mean, slept on straw mattresses, and it was cold. Greeter was one of the cold parts of Australia, Maitland. But somehow or other, I survived the 6 weeks and moved on to another unit.
How were the people in charge treating the recruits?
Oh, pretty lousy, actually, when I look back on them. Frustrated Second World War guys, you know, the corporals and some of the sergeants. In fact, there was a sergeant that I'd was still in the army in during the Vietnam days. His name came up a couple of times, and I'd always remember it was a first-class bastard. And he was still a sergeant in those days, so his promotion wasn't particularly rapid. But he was one of those sadistic bastards just striking these places.
Were they allowed to touch the recruits? Were they allowed to hit the recruits?
No. More the mental, you know, the mental frustration of... And I guess I was fairly fit. I was a country boy, a little bit fitter than some of the city boys, I'd imagine. But they like to humiliate you more than sort of physically hit you. And I guess I was a bit thin-skinned anyway.
Do you think the basic training did you any good?
Very difficult to say. I suppose it set my sights on what the army was all about anyway. It wasn't as glamorous stamping your foot and marching to the drums. As somebody said in Australia, that you could play get an army band and you could recruit the whole town if the army band marched up and down the street a few times. And we're into military music, that sort of thing. Looking back on basic training, no, it's a blot in my memory. I think I blotted it out after a while because I had had dealings with the Dowsets and these people.
With what?
The Dowsets, you know, the sergeant, that level of training.
The Dowsets?
Dowset was the sergeant, Sergeant Dowsets. You know, the Dowsets, yeah. I knew a few of these guys, you know, they'd gone to Pacific, some of them, and... I had no regard for them at all. He's the only one that stands out in my memory. So.
But do you think this kind of regime was necessary?
No, but I eventually ended up in a training battalion as a corporal, and I suppose I see my pattern of my behaviour and what I'd experienced as a recruit anyway.
So what happened to you after the basic training?
I was transferred to a unit in Queensland, which was a water transport unit, and they were engaged in bringing the bodies back from the jungles of from Papua New Guinea. I was there. I was only there maybe 6 months, and they wanted volunteers to go to Japan, the occupation forces. So I went to Japan, the occupation forces. That was in the October. So I said...
What was that like?
Oh, that was quite exciting, of course. 70-year-old, the all-white conqueror of Japan. And, that was 1946, and the place was still largely bombed out, as you can imagine.
Where were you based?
Kure.
What was the attitude of the Japanese towards you?
Very servile. They, excellent. I mean, there was no guerrilla warfare. There was no... there were no problems at all, as I saw. And respectful. When you realise just how cruel they'd been in the Pacific, you know, it's amazing they could be so quiet. And you called out to them, they'd stand to attention and bow their head. It's something that we weren't used to, of course. But we had absolutely no trouble whatsoever with them.
How did the Australians behave towards the Japanese?
Pardon?
How did the Australians behave towards the Japanese?
Well, I was in a soft unit. I wasn't in an infantry battalion in those days. I was in a docks operating unit. And we would do... the infantry battalions would do all the patrolling through the islands. But they never had any trouble. I think the only trouble that I was involved in was we'd taken a boat up to a place called Yamaguchi, and there was a local riot incited by the communists at that stage, but it all fizzled out. You never felt in any danger whatsoever from the Japanese.
Did you see the riot?
Yes, it was at the wharf, and we had a boat at the wharf.
What did the riot consist of?
Oh, a lot of haranguing by a speaker, you know, with the old-time politicking, where a guy got up on a van and through a tannoy spoke to the crowd. And there was an incident there that came up later on, and how true it is, I don't know. But during this, when this demonstration looked as though it was getting ugly, another Japanese jumped up on the platform and harangued the crowd and persuaded them to disperse, and they did disperse. And years later I heard that the Japanese, in fact, wasn't a Japanese person. It was an Australian, a guy by the name of Alex Weaver, who was in field security, but who looked Japanese and who spoke fluent Japanese. And Evil Weaver, he was called after a while, and he was a platoon commander in Korea, but I also knew him when he was in Japan, in Australia as well. And the same guy went back in, he was still in the army during the Vietnam period, and he went back in this Win the Hearts campaign, as I understand it was called at the time. But he was fluent in several languages, Japanese being one. And,
Did they actually turn violent, this crowd?
No.
But you mean that you thought they might turn violent?
Yes, well, we were pretty frightened. There was three of us on the boat, and the skipper of the boat was an Australian trying to decide whether to push away from the wharf and get out to sea or in the island, or stay tied up at the wharf, and eventually he stayed tied up at the wharf, but we were three nervous Nellies, I can tell you.
What were they demonstrating about?
I wouldn't know. At the time it was all in Japanese, but there were a communist element wanting to overthrow local government, and they had a 1946-47 fairly volatile politics in Japan anyway.
But was it directed against Japanese authority or yeah. against whites?
No, Japanese authority. It had nothing to do with the occupation forces.
Was there ever any trouble between individual Japanese or individual Australians?
I think there may have been, but I didn't hear. The Australian authorities and the British authorities kept a very tight rein on behaviour. We had a non-fraternisation ban. And first sign of trouble, of course, they'd come down very hard on the troops.
You said you were in this docks operating unit.
Yes.
Which part of the Australian Army did that belong to?
That'd be one of the administrative groups, Beecoff headquarters, down on the Kure docks. So I was a clerk at that time. I was, I think the The CO was an ex-Wharfie, and it's a pretty tough outfit, I can tell you. Yeah.
Is a Wharfie a docker?
Yes, a Wharfie is a docker. And they're pretty tough. I mean, I was still 17, of course, and I thought recruit training taught me a lot, but, you know, they were so violent as people. I remember them hanging one guy out the window by his ankles, you know, three stories up, and where they're going to drop him, they were all half drunk, and he'd been one of the black marketeers. And he cheated these guys, I believe, and all I could hear was a scream and sort of ran out. Here's this guy suspended by two drunken Aussies, about to drop him onto the concrete, which they didn't do, as it turned out.
Was he Australian or Japanese?
Oh, no, he's Australian. And they're so tough, you know, and the CO was tough, you know, and he would punch up the guys if he wanted to. He's just, I remember being absolutely terrified, and my father's a fairly gentle person, and this big hulk around, you know. Sorry. Quite unmilitary in those days. But that was the law. He was the law. And I remember they used to steal his Jeep. He was so tired he'd come home, and his Jeep was on the side of a hill. But despite the fact, you know, they could go to jail for 3 months in detention camp, they persisted in stealing his Jeep and driving it around town, somehow in the morning, getting it back into the garage before he woke up. I always wondered if he woke up in the middle of the night, decided to go down to the wharf, and suddenly found the Jeep wasn't there. What would happen?
What was this black market activity you mentioned?
Oh, there's a lot of black marketing. Sugar, the Japanese were sort of sugar. And a bag of sugar would come off on the boat, and instead of getting 20 tonne, you might end up with 19 tonne, and somebody would write 20 tonne on the document. It was a racket going on at the wharf. Mm. And strange enough, the guy that ran the black market, he'd been a deserter from the army during the war, and served his term in prison, so they then sent him into the occupation forces. And he certainly benefited from his going to Japan.
He
was a real crim, he really was in those days. And
he wasn't the one who was held out of the window?
Yes, he was the one held out the window. He could arrange anything. Yeah.
But he was the one who was held by the ankles.
Yes. He never learned.
Any other memories you've got from being in Japan?
No, not really. It's a beautiful country. I like the Japanese. I mean, I went to Hiroshima in November, which was... the bomb was dropped in August, so we're still comparatively new. Walking through the hospitals, thousands of people still suffering from burns. And, of course, the families used to look after them in those days. They didn't have hospitals as we would know them. It was pretty pathetic. It's pretty sad. The place was absolutely razed. And it's interesting to see... I had photos of it, and over the years, of course, you lose them, but you see pictures on TV now, and other people bring photographs back, and you couldn't believe this was the same city that was devastated.
How long were you in Japan?
I saw the Emperor once, Emperor Hirohito. In Japan, 12 months the first time. You do 12 months on time and so on. I came back to Australia and went to an infantry battalion, which is what I had always wanted anyway.
Which battalion was that?
That's the 2nd Battalion, Royal Australian Regiment.
Where did you join them?
In a place called Puckapunyal.
Is that New South Wales?
No, Victoria. It was the main, main training camp. There are 3 battalions in the regiment. One was still in Japan. One was in New South Wales and one was in Victoria. I was in a Victorian battalion.
What impression did you get of the unit when you joined it?
It was fairly new, and at that time I'd been a corporal. I was only 18, I was a corporal. But I'd been in the clerical side of it, and of course I wanted to be the real gung-ho infantry man. So I had to practice up my skills of giving commands, learning to fire a rifle, because clearly doctor operating units, you didn't fire too many guns. And I guess that's where I remained until the Korean War. I started as an instructor there. First of all, it was a battalion, then it became a training battalion for the battalion. I suppose the most exciting thing in that time was when Sir Thomas Blamey died, who was our first field marshal, and I was in the catapult party and had to bury old Tom. The interesting thing about that was that he'd been dying for several months, and the regimental band had been playing all sorts of death marches, and the troops were practicing, the catapult party was practicing, and then the Korean War started, and the band was hastily dispatched to Korea, and all the selected catapult party, they also went, you know, you became, went back to infantrymen instead of guardsmen. And I ended up as a sergeant in charge of the catapult party.
What did that involve?
Well, the body was lying in the shrine, had been there for a day or two, and all his enemies had to turn up to pay their respects, including General Rowell, who was had been dismissed by Blamey during the war. And they were the pallbearers. And the catapult party actually controlled the flow of the march. It's on the orders of the, you know, the quick march. You control the speed of the procession through the streets of Melbourne to the crematorium. And I suppose my lasting impression of feeling somewhat famous being in the catapult party, that we had an RSM, Regimental Sergeant Major, who had just arrived from being trained in England. And he marched just behind the catapult party, and that terrified me to start with. You know, here's this guy listening to every command, and you could hear him hissing in the background every time. And that woke me up a few times, you know. One, I was careful not to make a mistake, because we had the Prime Minister and all the heads of government there, and here's this hissing snake behind him, right, left. And he terrified me. And it was a cold Melbourne day. I don't, unless you've been to Australia, you wouldn't know what a cold Melbourne day is. It was something like 4 o'clock in London, gloomy, and it was about 3 o'clock, as it turned out, in Melbourne. And as the coffin was taken at the crematorium, first of all, the Archbishop calls out, "I am the resurrection and the life," which terrified me, because it was all fairly quiet up to this time, apart from our feet scraping on the gun. And then the 21 or 19 gun salute boomed out, so with the Archbishop screaming his head off and the guns going off, and the RSM behind me, I'd always remember the days that so glad the whole thing was over. But, it was captured on newsreel, and I remember going to the newsreel half a dozen times watching myself. But
what effect did the news that a war in Korea had broken out have on you?
Well, there was great excitement. We all thought it was a great idea. I've been training for it. I'd been in the army since the war broke out in the 50s. Australia committed the troops in the fairly soon, I think it was September. But in Korea, of course, we only had a half of a battalion, so the other half of the battalion had to come out of Australia from the regular army, or the as the army decided they would have a Korean force as well. Made up of ex-servicemen. But what they didn't say was whilst they particularly wanted infantrymen, they got everybody else, you know, people who hadn't settled down after the Second World War. In fact, they got a really good mix, you know, guys with distinguished conduct medals, military medals, and very good soldiers all in all, but not parade ground soldiers as such.
Can you tell me about the preparations you made for going to Korea yourself, please?
Well, personally...
Yes, please.
I was very disappointed in the... there were two batches. Well, there were more than two, but the initial batch were the, more the specialist people, the signal sergeants like the Galloways, the machine gun people, the more specialist arms of the infantry. And I wasn't a specialist, I was a simple corporal in those days. And they had plenty of corporals. So, and I was actually in a training battalion, the company, training company. So they took the guys out of the main battalion, so I was very disappointed and a lot of my mates went when I thought I should have gone too. And that was my initial disappointment. A friend of mine who wasn't on the draft but happened to be the orderly sergeant, he, orderly room sergeant, he put his name on the list unbeknown to the commanding officer, and the commanding officer signs everything. And he heads off to Korea, and the next day they were looking for him. They said, where is he? Oh, he's in Sydney. And they work out 2 or 3 days later that, in fact, he put his name on. I always wished he would have put my name on too, but that's the way it went. And I wasn't in the first draft to Korea. I went in the October the following year. No, I went in September the following year.
September 51.
September 51. I think they were anticipating a number of casualties. There was a general feed of people from the battalion. We had two battalions in Australia, 2nd Battalion where I was and the 1st Battalion in New South Wales. And each of the battalion would feed cannon fodder as they wanted it, I guess. Mainly at that stage, infantrymen, sergeants, corporals, had a heavy toll of NCOs and officers early in the piece. So I eventually went to Korea in the October, at the end of the, which was Operation Commando. I went to Don Company as a sergeant. I was a sergeant by then.
Can you tell me about travelling to Korea, please?
Flew, was all by Qantas in those days. We went from Victoria across to Sydney, from Sydney to Darwin overnight, Darwin to Manila, and from Manila into Iwakuni, which was in Japan, southern Japan. The overnight stop at Manila was exciting in that it was a time of the Hak Rebellion, and the plane had no sooner landed than the Filipino armed forces rushed on board with their guns cocked, and you know, we all thought we were great soldiers, but we certainly settled down our seats and didn't make any noise when these guys marched up and down, but they eventually let us off the aircraft, and we flew off that night to Iwakuni.
Why were they so edgy?
Well, they worried about people getting through the airport, and you know, I think it was just a little bit of fright of the shadows in many ways. I guess it was the main airport too. But that was a Hak Rebellion. It settled down some 12 months later, I understand. Arrival in Japan, went straight to a holding, what we call a holding reinforcement